Thinking is Being teaches us how to examine and alter our thinking to bring truth and harmony into our lives. All the Bible quotes are from Matthew chapter 5.
Ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt have lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing, but to be cast out and to be trodden under foot of men. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven.
In this wonderful passage, Jesus is addressing those who have awakened to the understanding of material bondage and have acquired some spiritual understanding of the nature of being. That is to say, he is addressing those who understand the meaning of the allness of God or good, and the powerlessness of evil in the face of truth. Such people he describes as being the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And indeed, that is not too much to claim for those who understand the truth and who really live the life that corresponds to it. It is possible, and in fact only too easy, to accept these vital principles as being true, to love the beauty in them, and yet not to put them constantly into practice in one's own life. But this won't work. Because in that case, the salt has lost its savor and is good for nothing but to be cast out and trodden underfoot. If you understand and accept the teachings of Jesus and make every effort to practice them in every department of your own daily life, if you seek systematically to change in yourself everything that keeps you from God, such as selfishness, pride, vanity, promiscuity, self-righteousness, jealousy, self-pity, resentment, condemnation, and so forth, not by feeding or nourishing them by giving in, but starving them by refusing to give them any thought or expression. If you extend the right thought loyally to every person or thing in your life, especially to the people or things you dislike, then you are among those called the salt of the earth. If you truly live this life, then it doesn't match in the least what your present circumstances may be, or what difficulties you may have against you. You will triumph over them all and make your demonstration, and you will be in every positive and literal sense a healing and illuminating influence on all around you, and a blessing to the whole human race.
Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid.
The state of your soul is always expressed in your outer conditions and in the intangible influence which you radiate at large. There is a cosmic law that nothing can permanently deny its own nature. Emerson said, "What you are, shout so loudly that I cannot hear what you say." In the Bible, the city always stands for consciousness, and the hill or mountain always means prayer or spiritual activity. I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills from whence cometh my help. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh, but in vain.
Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven.
The soul that is built upon prayer cannot be hidden. It shines out brightly through the life that it lives. It speaks for itself, but in utter silence, and does much of its best work unconsciously. Its mere presence heals and blesses all around it without special effort. No one can force another person to accept spiritual truth, but if people are favorably impressed by your life or your behavior and by the peace and joy that radiates from you, they will come to you of their own accord, wanting to be near the wonderful thing that you have.
Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law, till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments, and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say unto you, that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven.
True Christianity is an entirely positive influence. It comes into a man's life to enlarge and enrich it, to make it fuller and wider and better, never to restrict it. You cannot lose anything that is worth having through acquiring a knowledge of the truth. There has to be sacrifice, but only the sacrifice of things that one is much happier without. Never of anything that is really worth having. Many people have the idea that getting a better knowledge of God will mean giving up the things that they will regret losing the most. Some people mean to take up religion later on when they are older, because they want to enjoy themselves for a while first. This concept misses the whole point. The things one has to sacrifice are selfishness, fear, and belief in necessary limitation of any kind. Above all, one has to sacrifice the belief that there is any power or endurance in evil, apart from the power that we ourselves give it by believing in it. Drawing near to God doesn't cause the loss of any enjoyment, but gives us immeasurable happiness. When we stay near to God, our consciousness changes, and we find that certain forms of pleasure-seeking will no longer attract us. When this happens, there is ample compensation in the new light that is thrown upon every phase of our life, and in the wonderful new aspects that the world begins to hold for us. Only the things not worth having disappear under the action of truth.
Only the things not worth having disappear under the action of truth.
Some suppose that the knowledge of truth of being puts them above the moral law, in the sense of having special authorization. In fact, the more spiritual knowledge we possess, the more responsibility we have to be aware of our own moral code in every facet of our lives. All sincere spiritual understanding is accompanied by moral improvement. But real spiritual progress comes from living God's truth with right thinking and right behavior.
For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled.
A jot, the Greek iota, means the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. The tittle, meaning little horn, is one of those tiny spurs or projections that distinguishes one Hebrew letter from another. The thought is that not only the letter of the moral law is to be kept, but the smallest detail of the letter. We have to exemplify not merely common morality, but the highest standards of honor.
For I say unto you, that except your righteousness shall be exceeded by the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven.
The scribes and the Pharisees were, for the most part, worthy men leading strictly moral lives. Unfortunately, they had only the letter of the law, but that letter they usually kept in its entirety, rigorously doing their duty as they saw it. Their faults were the fatal weaknesses of the religious formalist everywhere, spiritual pride and self-righteousness. They were unconscious of these faults and did strive to fulfill the law as they understood it. Jesus knew this and gave them credit for it, but warns his followers that unless their lives are in every respect as good as and even better than that of these people, they need not suppose that they are making any spiritual headway. Spiritual attainment and the highest standards of conduct must go hand in hand. Unless both are there, neither is there.
As you grow in true spiritual power and understanding, you will actually find that many outer rules and regulations will become unnecessary, because you have really risen above them. This point in your development, where your understanding of truth enables you to dispense with certain outer props and regulations, is the spiritual coming of age.
To give a simple illustration, Some people find that at a certain stage of their progress, their mental processes become so orderly and clarified that they can go through their day's work, keep all their appointments, and discharge all their duties without bothering to consult a clock or needing to wear a watch. When the student is spiritually ready to dispense with his watch, he will find himself doing the right thing at the right time, without thinking about the watch at all. The point is not to attain mastery over time. The proper course is to wear a watch, be aware of time, and devote our thoughts and prayers to things that really matter, such as healing ourselves and others, overcoming weakness, working for understanding and wisdom, and the larger issues of life. The spiritual coming of age cannot be hurried or forced, but must appear in its own good time, when the consciousness is ready, exactly as the flowering of a bulb can only be the result of natural growth. You have to be who you are, where you are. Know that in your heart of hearts, you have to demonstrate where you are. Occasionally, we see people who try to demonstrate beyond their spiritual level. For example, someone may be ill and refuse to take medical treatment because they believe that the Holy Spirit alone will heal them. Although it is perfectly advisable to practice scientific prayer, giving God total power to heal and to make the illness disappear, it is also advisable to seek God's help through the healing hands of a trained physician.
What about the man who has considerable moral imperfections, perhaps in the habit of a grave error of character, and yet at the same time sincerely desires spiritual growth? Is he to relinquish the quest for spiritual knowledge until he reforms his conduct? Surely not. As a matter of fact, any attempt to improve himself morally without spiritual growth is destined for failure. To use Abraham Lincoln's phrase, "No more can a man raise himself off the ground by pulling on his own bootstraps than the sinner can reform himself by his own personal efforts." The only thing to do is pray regularly, especially at the actual times of temptation, and to give the responsibility for success to God. We must continue in this method no matter how many times we fail, and if we continue to pray, we'll soon find that we are free from that particular problem. To pray scientifically is to keep affirming that God is helping us, that the temptation has no power against us, and constantly to claim that our own real nature is spiritual and perfect. This is much more powerful than to merely evoke the help of God. In this way, moral regeneration and spiritual unfoldment will go hand in hand. The Christian life doesn't require that we possess perfection of character, or else who would be able to live it? What it does require is honest, genuine striving for that perfection.
Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, "Thou shalt not kill," and "Whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment." But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, "Raca," shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, "Thou fool," shall be in danger of hell fire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift.
The old law, dealing as it did with an earlier and lower state of consciousness of mankind, concerned itself necessarily with external things, for man's apparent evolution is from the outer to the inner, just as his fundamental spiritual growth is from the inner to the outer. He begins by giving his attention exclusively to externals, thinking to find in them cause as well as effect. But as mankind progresses, the truth gradually dawns on him that outer things are the finished article, only the result of causes and happenings on the inner. And at this stage, he has started definitely upon the search for God. The old law said, "Thou shalt not kill," and provided man did not murder, he kept the law, regardless of how much he may have desired to commit murder, or how much bitterly he might still hate his enemy. It said, "Thou shalt not steal," and provided man did not appropriate his neighbor's property, he fulfilled the law, no matter how he really felt. Jesus came to carry the human race forward to the next great step, the most important step of all, which can indeed be the final step in the overcoming of all our limitations, if we can understand clearly what that step implies, and take it. The heart of the whole Sermon on the Mount, which is itself the essence of the Christian message, is the insistence upon the need for this step, the understanding that outer conformity, absolutely essential as it is no longer sufficient in itself, but that now, if we are to come of age spiritually, we have to not merely conform outwardly to outer rules, but to change the inner self also.
Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, Thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment.
The old law said, Thou shalt not kill. But Jesus says that even to want to kill, even to be angry with your fellow man, is sufficient to keep you out of the kingdom of heaven. It was a distinct gain when primitive, barbarous people could be persuaded not to murder those who had offended them. But spiritual demonstration requires that anger itself be overcome. We have to release the resentment and condemnation of ourselves and others before we can truly experience God and His power of healing. In prayer, the more love, the more power. And this is why people of developed spiritual perception take such constant pains to keep themselves free from thoughts of criticism and condemnation. They know that they can have either their demonstration or their indignation, but they can't have both, and so they don't waste time trying.
Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift.
Indignation, resentment, the desire to punish other people, or to see them punished, the desire to get even, the feeling it serves him right, all these things form a quite impenetrable barrier to spiritual power or progress. Jesus, dramatizing in the Oriental way, says that if you are bringing a gift to the altar and you remember that your brother has anything against you, you must put down your gift without attempting to offer it and go away to make peace with your brother. And then, when you have done that, your offering will be acceptable. It was the old law to take gifts of all kinds to the temple. Now, under the new law, Jesus means that our altar is our own consciousness, and our offerings are our prayers and treatments. Our burnt sacrifices are the error thoughts which we let go of or burn away in spiritual treatment. And so Jesus says that when we are about to pray, if we remember that we have any wrong thoughts or hard feelings about our brother man, no matter who he may be, and regardless of whether the object of our hostile thought is an individual or a body of people, we must pause and practice love towards them until we have released this sense of hostility and have once more restored the seamless garment of our spiritual integrity.
But I say to you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment, and whosoever shall say to his brother Raca shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, Thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire.
Jesus builds up this tremendous lesson, again in the Oriental tradition, by employing a series of steps, three in this case. He says, first, that whoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger. Secondly, to be seriously or vindictively hostile to another is to be in grave danger. And finally, that to hold so low an opinion about a fellow human being that we allow ourselves to consider him beneath us, then we have shut ourselves off from any hope of spirituality while we remain in this state of mind. To call a man a fool in this sense means that we consider that nothing good is to be expected from him, which is to deny his indwelling Christ. Jesus says, whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause. No sane person gets angry without what he deems to be a cause, however trifling the cause may be. What Jesus means is that whoever is angry with his brother, under any circumstance, is in danger.
Agree with thine adversary quickly whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence, till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing.
This paragraph is of the utmost practical importance. Jesus is stressing here the instruction contained in his message to watch and pray. It's so much easier to overcome a difficulty if you tackle it immediately, at its first appearance, than it will be after the trouble has had some time to establish itself in your mentality. The moment evil presents itself to your attention, you should immediately turn it out, refuse to accept it, and by quietly affirming the truth, give it no chance to enter your life. If you do this, you will find that it has little or no power over you. Even if you don't experience results right away, don't give up. Give truth the power, and the power of truth comes back to you. On the other hand, by accepting the evil and by thinking about it, you are giving the power to evil and incorporating it into your mentality. And if you go on doing this long enough, it may be exceedingly difficult to get rid of. We find it comparatively easy, once we have learned to pray scientifically, to overcome new difficulties as they present themselves. But the older ones, whose position we have fortified by years of acceptance, are difficult to dislodge. Jesus, in accordance with his usual custom, when he wished to drive home a particular important point, employed a graphic illustration from the everyday life of the people around him. In those times, the law governing debtors was extremely severe. When a man found himself in debt, it strongly behooved him to come to terms with his creditor by an acceptable means and as quickly as possible. Even at the present day, it is highly important for someone in debt to keep his case from coming to court, if possible, because there are so many additional costs that are added to the original debt. The longer the case drags on, so do lawyers' fees, court costs, and all sorts of expenses accumulate. Indeed, cases are cited where the costs involved in legal proceedings actually exceeded the original debt. It's the same with the various difficulties that present themselves to us in our daily lives. The original difficulty usually becomes multiplied many times by all our wrong thoughts concerning it, and we aren't free until the whole debt is cleared.
By coming to terms in the first place, this is to say, by getting our thoughts right immediately concerning the difficulty, we incur no further cost, and the transaction remains a simple one. When the error first presents itself to our consciousness, that is to say, at the first moment that the possibility of catching cold occurs, either through sneezing or feeling chilly, we should immediately reject it, claim our dominion, and affirm the truth. The cold may never appear or run its course much sooner. Business or family difficulty should be handled in exactly the same way. Usual behavior when finding bad news concerning business affairs is to accept the worst and to dwell upon it at almost any length. Many people will saturate themselves with the thought of ruin, discuss it in great detail with others, and rehearse every kind of trouble and difficulty that might result. In addition to all this, there would, in many cases, be bitter resentment and condemnation towards the people held to be responsible for the bad news. Even a very slight knowledge of the causative powers of our thought will show us that the result of all this must inevitably be to increase and multiply the trouble and make it more and more difficult to escape.
As students of the Christ teaching, we will sooner or later start to drive all negative thought out of our mentality, substituting the true law of being. And to do this, according to Jesus, is to immediately turn to God, our real support, and refuse to accept the suggestion of trouble as binding upon us, and literally drive the thought of loss and danger right out of our consciousness, together with the fear and resentment that go with it. If we do this, working steadily until our peace of mind is restored, we will presently find ourselves safely out of difficulty. In some way or other, the trouble will disappear. The same principle would, of course, apply equally to any kind of difficulty whatever, since universal harmony is the true law of being. A dispute, a quarrel, or misunderstanding should be handled in the same way from the first moment you become aware of it. Whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved.
Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, Thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her, hath committed adultery with her already in his heart.
Jesus stresses the master truth, so utterly fundamental, yet so unsuspected by the world at large, that what really matters is thought. People have always been accustomed to suppose that as long as their deeds conform to the law, they have done all that can be expected. Now, we know that the thought we allow to become habitual will sooner or later find expression on the plane of action. In the light of scientific Christianity, thoughts literally are things, and that our choice of conduct really lies in our choice of the kind of thought that we permit to occupy the stage of our mind. In other words, we have discovered that a wrong thought is just as destructive an act as a wrong deed. Keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life.
This concludes Side One, Thinking is Being. Thank you for listening. Turn the tape over to learn about directing life despite life's direction, keeping the integrity of our soul in the face of life's difficulties.
And if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell.
The integrity of the soul is the one and only thing that matters. And so, Jesus, in his teaching, is almost exclusively concerned with impressing us with the importance of this fact, and with instructing us on how we are to accomplish it. Cost what it will, involve what it may, the integrity of the soul must be preserved, for everything else follows upon that: behavior, health, prosperity, and life itself. Better to sacrifice your right eye or right hand so that your soul may obtain the clarity of understanding. That is salvation. Jesus means that any error of character, any grudge left unforgiven, any greed for the things of this world, whatever stands between us and our true contact with God, must be eliminated from our lives. These things, however, are fairly obvious. It's the subtle things like self-love and self-righteousness, spiritual pride and so forth, that are the most difficult for the self to detect and correct, but must be done. Sometimes the practice of a certain profession or the association with certain people or membership to some particular body is standing in our way, and if so, must become part of the past.
It hath been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, committeth adultery.
We are told that in those days, divorces were granted by the rabbinical law on the most trifling grounds. Married people who were not getting on together as well as they would have liked were too prone to run away from their problems by obtaining an easy disillusion and then trying their luck with someone else. Now we understand that no permanent happiness can be obtained in this way. As long as you are running away from your problem, you will continue to meet it in a new disguise at every turn in the road. The scientific solution is to meet your difficulty where you are by means of spiritual treatment or scientific prayer. This applies to problems concerning marriage quite as much as, if not more than, to problems of any other kind. As none of us is perfect, and the one complaining is certain to have his or her own faults no less than the one complained about, then if it can possibly be done, make the present marriage a success by persistently knowing the spiritual truth about each other. If the aggravated partner will see the Christ truth about the other one, then in nearly every case, a happy solution will be the outcome. One woman said, after a few months of handling her problem spiritually, "The man I was going to divorce has disappeared, and the man I married has come back. We are perfectly happy again." Just as in running from one business position to another, or from one home to another, without first having brought about a change in consciousness, we find ourselves repeating the old conditions in a slightly different way. So as a rule, people who divorce freely, trying marriage after marriage, are apt to finish up as dissatisfied as they began. The general rule in truth is, fight out your problem where you are, with prayer. Nevertheless, there is a limit to what a man or a woman can be expected to put up with in marriage. And in certain cases, no doubt, the lesser evil is a disillusion. But this should be only the last resort. Jesus, we know, consistently refrained from laying down hard and fast rules and regulations for the details of our conduct, knowing that if our principles were right, such things would take care of themselves without fail. And we may be sure of that. With this supremely practical and common sense handling of human problems, he would have given the wise and merciful decision in any particular case. In the time of Moses, adulterers were stoned to death under the law. But under the guidance of the scriptures, Moses forgave and dismissed them in peace. At any rate, those who are in any doubt concerning their own conduct in this matter have a simple remedy. They should pray for guidance. They should claim that divine wisdom is illuminating their understanding and direction of their actions in the matter, and avoid taking any definite steps until they find a clear leading in their own consciousness. The general rule is still good for all conditions in life. Rather than trying to divorce or amputate the inharmony, let it dissolve away of itself under treatment or prayer. That is what was done by the woman who said that the man she married had come back, and she considers her demonstration a perfect one.
Again ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, Thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whosoever is more than these cometh of evil.
Swear not at all is one of the cardinal points in the teaching of Jesus. It means, briefly, that we are not to take vows. We are not to mortgage our future conduct in advance. We are not in any way to seek to fix our conduct or our belief for tomorrow while it is still today, for sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. It's an absolutely vital part of his teaching that we are constantly to seek direct inspirational contact with God. If we are to receive the guidance of God, divine wisdom, it is absolutely essential that we have an open mind, because the wisdom we receive may not be in accord with our own personal feelings or present opinions. Not staying open in our thoughts and beliefs is what the Bible calls the sin against the Holy Ghost, or any action within ourselves which prevents the activity of the presence of God from taking place in our soul. The symptoms of this malady are spiritual stagnation and an all-round unhappy life, too often accompanied by feelings of self-righteousness and spiritual pride. The only cure is a change of attitude. Of course, Jesus doesn't mean that we are not to enter into ordinary business engagements. These things are matters of legal convenience for the transaction of business between man and man. They are right and necessary in an ordered society. The Sermon on the Mount, as we have seen, is based on the spiritual life, for the spiritual life controls all the rest.
But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King.
Many of the churches still require their ministers upon ordination, and usually while they are still quite young with immature minds, to solemnly promise or vow that they will, for the whole of their future lives, continue to believe the doctrines of their particular sect. And this is what Jesus especially wished to prevent. If we are praying every day as we should for enlightenment and guidance, the one certain thing is that we will not go on holding to the same ideas as we grow older, but that we will be continually revising, enlarging, and expanding them. We will die daily as we are, to be reborn bigger and wiser and better for tomorrow. We must always be perfectly free at any moment to conduct the affairs of our soul as the action of divine wisdom may lead us, to pray or not to pray, to pray in this way or that way, and for this or for that purpose, to read or not to read any book, to attend or not to attend churches or meetings as we may feel led.
The most important application of this injunction against making hard and fast rules lies in the matter of our prayers. Many people have made rigid rules for the conduct of their personal prayers or devotions, but these are sure to destroy the spirit of the thing sooner or later. People say, I always start with the Lord's Prayer, or a certain psalm, or I begin every treatment in such and such a way. All this is a mistake. We should always pray as we feel led to do by the action of the Holy Spirit in our soul at the moment that carries power. A thought that is given to us in this way has considerably more power to demonstrate than one that we consciously select for ourselves or borrow from any other source. Remember, however, that it's only hard and fast rules that are to be avoided. It's a good idea to have some kind of schedule for prayer to fall back upon at times when nothing better presents itself. In fact, most people will need a schedule in the beginning. The essential point is that we must always be ready to drop it at a moment's notice under the guidance of the Spirit. If our prayers seem to bring no result, or if we feel stagnate in our means of prayer, we can go to our secret place for inspiration, and then use the first thought that comes. Or try dipping into the Bible at random and find an inspired direction.
Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil.
This section further teaches that we must not undertake to bring about particular events or conditions, or particular solutions to our problems, what is technically called outlining. When we find ourselves in difficulties, we should pray for harmony and freedom, and expect to get it. But we should not seek to select the exact arrangement that will come about, or the course that things will take. If we make up our minds very firmly that we are going to get a particular thing, we very likely will. But this exercise of willpower is almost certain to create difficulties. Yea, yea, and nay, nay stand for what is called in scientific prayer the affirmation and the denial, respectively. These are the affirmation of truth and harmony and the omnipresence of God in reality, and the denial of any power in error or limitation.
Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn thou not away.
When we accept the Jesus Christ message, nothing is ever the same again. All values change radically. Compared with Jesus, all the so-called revolutionists, radicals, and reformers of history are now seen to have only been merely scratching the surface, rearranging unimportant externals, whereas Jesus went down to the root of things. The old law, designed to maintain some degree of order among a barbarous people, had said an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. To whatever extent he maimed or wounded another, he himself would be made to suffer. For barbarous people, unable to look forward beyond the passion of the moment, this did, no doubt, in most cases, furnish an effective check upon primitive instinct. Then, as time went on and barbarism gradually passed into a settled civilization, this primitive code was slowly modified by public opinion into something at least less obviously brutal. This was the case as far as public justice was concerned. In private life, however, the ancient code continues to hold sway in men's hearts and minds to this day, even though they no longer perpetrate the same deeds of violence. When we've been hurt or suffered injustice or witnessed things which we did not approve, the desire to get even, to get one's own back, to even things up somehow or other is still with us all and will remain with us until the time when we definitely take ourselves in hand and change it. Revenge lies at the root of all the strife in the world, public and private. It is the direct cause of international wars, of family feuds and personal quarrels, and ill health. Now Jesus reverses this and says that when someone injures you, instead of seeking to get your own back or to repay him in his own method, you are to do the very opposite. You are to forgive him and set him free. No matter what the provocation may be, and no matter how many times it's repeated, this is what to do. You are to free him and let him go, for only then can you be freed yourself. Only then can you possess your own soul. Hatred ceases not with hatred, says the Asian philosophy enunciating this great cosmic truth many centuries ago. And Jesus put it in the forefront of his teaching because it is the cornerstone of man's salvation.
This doctrine of resist not evil is a great metaphysical secret. To the world, or to those who don't understand, it sounds like moral suicide, the feeblest surrendering to the aggressor. But in the light of the Jesus Christ revelation, it is seen to be superb spiritual strategy. Antagonize any situation and we give it power against us. Offer mental non-resistance and it crumbles away.
But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also.
Jesus gives us no instructions for details of external conduct, and so the references here to suing at law, to coat and cloak, to lending and borrowing, to turning the other cheek, are illustrative and symbolic of mental states and are not to be taken in the narrow, literal sense. This statement, however, is not in any way an endeavor to evade or gloss over a difficult text. We cannot remind ourselves too often that if the thought is right, the deed cannot be wrong. No teacher could ever say that a given act must necessarily be right at any time, because the play of circumstances in human life is too hopelessly complicated for any such prediction. This instruction about turning the other cheek refers to the changing of one's thoughts when faced by error, changing from the error to the truth. And as a rule, it works like magic. When someone is behaving badly, instead of thinking about the trouble, immediately switch your attention off of the human to the divine and concentrate upon God or upon the real spiritual self of the person in question. And you will find, if you really do this, that their behavior will change. This is the secret of handling difficult people, and Jesus understood it thoroughly. If people are troublesome, you have only to change your thought about them, and then they will change too, because your own concept is what you see. It's been tried thousands and thousands, perhaps millions of times, and it never fails when properly carried out. Sometimes we find ourselves in company where the conversation is very negative, with sickness and trouble being described and dwelt upon at great length, or perhaps uncharitable statements are made about other people. For various reasons, it may be difficult to withdraw. Therefore, mentally, turn the other cheek, helping both the speakers and their victims.
And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away.
Let him have thy cloak also, and go with him twain, are dramatic expressions that even further emphasize the principle of non-resistance in thought to seemingly evil conditions. Meet the attitude of fellow men sympathetically, as far as you possibly can. Concede every point that is not absolutely essential, and redeem the remainder with the true thought of Christ. Never surrender to error, of course, but it's the error, and not the one who errs, that is to be avoided.
Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. And pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth the rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if ye salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect.
Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute you. Hatred ceases not with hatred is here again the theme. And now Jesus puts this fundamental truth in such a plain and simple way that no one can misunderstand him. Instead of hating our enemies as our lower instinct impels us to do, we are to love them. For curses we return blessings, and hatred we reward with good. For our spiritual enlightenment, we need to be void of all sense of resentment and hostility and change our state of mind until we are conscious only of harmony and peace within and have a sense of positive goodwill towards all. This is not merely the most practical policy, but for the reasons upon which the whole Sermon on the Mount is founded, it is the only policy where progress is possible. Physical health itself, in the long run, is not possible without forgiveness and goodwill to everyone. And even material prosperity will disappear unless our soul is free from hatred and condemnation. In the understanding of what is called the spiritual idea, here is a wonderful lesson in practical spiritual treatment or scientific prayer. Quite simply, the spiritual idea is the understanding of the basic fact that good is permanent, omnipresent, and all-powerful. And evil is a temporary, insubstantial belief without character of its own, which is destroyed by scientific prayer. The only existence evil has is that which you give it by temporarily ensouling it with your thought. Withdraw this, and it fades into nothingness. Unthink it. It's always your thinking that matters. To quote Shakespeare, there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Fear, hatred, and resentment are ideas heavily charged with emotion. And when added to any difficulty, recharge it with fresh and vigorous life and make it all the more difficult to overcome. Again, the mere rehearsing in thought of any difficulty endows it with new life. Going over old grievances mentally, thinking how badly someone acted and recalling the details has the effect of reviving what was quietly expiring of neglect.
We mold our own life destiny day by day, entirely by the manner in which we react mentally to experience as it comes. Right action is the supreme art of life. And Jesus compressed the secret of that art into a sentence when he said, "Resist not evil." As soon as we resist mentally any undesirable or unwanted circumstance, we endow it with more power. Power which it will use against us and deplete our own resources. Whether we have to meet a physical, a personal, or a business difficulty, we mustn't belabor it mentally or block or deny its existence. Instead, we should reach out mentally for the presence of God and hold that thought steadily that the presence is with us, and also with the person or the place where the evil has presented itself. This is the true spiritual method of loving your enemy.
That ye may be the children of your Father which art in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust.
God is love and is therefore absolutely all-powerful. This is the scientific application of love, against which nothing evil can stand. Loving your enemies in this scientific way is also the key to health, by which the secret of physical well-being lies in the realization of divine life and divine love. All physical improvement follows after this. It does not precede it. We know the importance of the glands for the proper functioning of our bodies, and our glands are governed entirely by our emotions. Therefore, the way to adjust and regulate the glands is by the cultivation of right feeling. And this must extend to our subconscious feelings, which can only be done by treatment, by prayer.
Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect.
This command of Jesus is one of the most tremendous things in the whole Bible. Consider carefully what he is saying. He is commanding us to be perfect, even as God himself is perfect. And as we know, Jesus doesn't ask the impossible. He gives us his authority to the doctrine that it is possible for man to become divinely perfect, and moreover, he tells us to do it. Therefore, man can't possibly be the miserable, hopeless sinner that theology has too often represented him to be, but that we are the very offspring of God, our Father which is in heaven, and are potentially divine and perfect. As Jesus elsewhere puts it, quoting the ancient scripture, "I said, ye are gods, and all of you sons of the Most High." He then added by way of emphasis, "and the scripture cannot be broken." Now, if we really are the children of God, capable of eternal and flawless perfection, then there can be no real power in evil, not even in sin, to keep us permanently in bondage. Using right thinking, it can only be a matter of time before we assume our true condition of spiritual salvation. I will arise and go unto my Father and take the kingdom of heaven by storm. This concludes Side 2, Directing Life Despite Life's Direction. Thank you for listening.